global argument, the global version, if you like, the original version. And essentially what you end up with is the following dichotomy, which we wrote down, which was that you have a surface, if you have a surface, which is Lagrangian section, and with a, what I call, totally real hemisphere, and then on the other, so there's no complex points, and it projects over S2 onto a hemisphere, and on this side you have a single complex point. So this is the kind of dichotomy. This was property one, implied that co-kernel was zero, right? So the argument was this, and on the other hand you could attach holomorphic disks here, so that would imply the co-kernel was not zero of the linearization of the del bar operator. So that in a nutshell is a kind of the contradiction, property one and property two, I think I called them last day. Okay, so let's now see, can you extend that to some kind of local index bound? And this is this is done by a kind of a semi-local method, which I want to describe. So let me just talk about complex points in general on a real surface in a complex surface. So if you take complex points, so I guess in our interpretation, we have complex points correspond to, so an isolated complex point corresponds to an isolated umbilic point, and it's on a Lagrangian surface. So this is, we'll occasionally drop back to R3 maybe to get some kind of picture of what it is that we're going to do. Moreover, there's a notion of an umbilic index, and there is also a notion of a complex index, the complex index of the oriented line. So, in fact, the relationship between this is a half integer and this is an integer, and it's not hard to see that that's twice I. Okay, and so in R3, here you have your surface, here you have your point P, and your oriented line gamma. That's an umbilic point here, when in TS2, the space of oriented lines, the oriented normals, which form a Lagrangian surface, have an isolated complex point. Okay, so this was the dictionary that we talked about, not last talk, but the talk before that. Okay, so let's look at this idea, first of all. Let's notice that generically, so if you look generically, the complex index of an isolated point, generically, complex points are isolated. That's the first thing that you might mention. So if you take it's plus or minus one. So here, let me just start. So sigma is contained in MJ. So it's a real surface inside a complex surface. So we'll just talk at that level of generality for the time being. So generically, if you're on this real surface, you'll have complex points, and these complex points will generically be isolated, and their index will be plus or minus 1. If you interpret if it's on a Lagrangian one, well, then these would be umbilic points of plus or minus 1/2. So this is the kind of standard or generic kind of situation. Moreover, there's a global bound on the total number of complex points. So to do that, I have to introduce I plus, which is, so I plus, a complex point is one where J preserves the tangent space, and it can do so in an oriented way or an unoriented way. So you have positive complex points and you have negative complex points, and you can sum those indices separately. And let's call them I plus and I minus. This is the sum of the indices of the positive complex points, sum of the indices of the negative. And this is not plus or minus 1, but rather through the orientation in the ambient space. And then you have what are called Lie's formulae, which says that I plus plus I minus is the Euler number of the tangent bundle plus the Euler number of the normal bundle. So we assume this is embedded. Right, so we assume this is a smooth embedded surface. An Euler number of the normal bundle, and then you have the difference between them is the first Chern class of the ambient evaluated on the surface. So this holds for any real surface in a complex surface. You have these index formula, which counts the number of positive and negative complex points. So let's just think about it in our situation. How would you see that for a global Lagrangian section? So for a global Lagrangian section in TS2, well, you have a sphere, so the Euler number of the tangent bundle is 2. In fact, that's equal to the Euler number of the normal bundle. So if you close convex surface, Euler number of the normal bundle is why? Well, it's because it's Lagrangian. J gives an isomorphism between the tangent and normal, so therefore they're equal. That would be one quick way to do it. Another way to do it would be to say, well, take a sphere in R3, and to find the Euler number of its normal bundle, look at its oriented normal lines and translate it and see how many self-intersections it has. So it'll have 2 self-intersections, one in that direction, one in that direction, so they turn out to have the same sign, so that's why you get 2 there. Okay, so therefore what you find is that the sum... in this case, this is 4, and I minus turns out to be 0, because they're all oriented, positively oriented. So this tells us that on a typical or a generic Lagrangian section, you expect to see 4 plus 1 complex points. Or in R3, on a closed convex surface, you expect to see 4, generically, you expect to see 4 plus a half indices, as in the triaxial ellipsoid. Okay, so let's note 2 things. So let's go to R3. Let's look at the plus a half. So in R3, so let's look at these isolated umbilic points of index plus or minus a half. So these are the generic ones that you will have if you perturb your surface. So what does the foliation look like? Well, it looks like for I equals plus a half, that's your foliation. In fact, it looks exactly like the top of a triaxial ellipsoid, as we claim. And on the other hand, for a index minus a half, it looks like this. So if you look at the winding number of that, it's an unoriented, you look at the unoriented winding number of that, you find it's minus a half. So here your index is minus 1/2. So this would be the foliation of the principal lines of curvature on the surface S. So this would all be on your surface S. There's your isolation umbilic point. This would be the principal foliation would look like this. Over here, again, you're on some surface, a convex surface S. You can write them down easily. And this would be what you expect to see. Okay. Let's step back a little bit. Let's get back to the general complex setting. So in the complex setting, how would you look at that? Well, in the complex setting, and it's a graph, you assume it's a graph, and I'll use my complex coordinates like sine eta, you have, say, alpha, a generic one looks like as follows. Xi, let me just see which way I use this. In beta, yeah. Xi bar squared plus beta xi bar plus cubed. So a typical complex point at the origin, generically to lowest order, will look like this. And if the norm of alpha is bigger than 2 beta, twice the norm of beta, then it's a hyperbolic, what's called a hyperbolic complex point. This is where your index is minus 1. It's this one here. So it's this one here I want to look at, not the case of the plus a half, which is the triaxial ellipsoid case. I'm not interested in it. It's the minus half. These are called hyperbolic complex points. Okay, and when alpha is greater than the norm of 2 beta, this is a hyperbolic one. And in fact, in that case, you can do a deformation to make it, you can kill the beta, in fact. And so you just get alpha xi bar squared. You can just do a homotopy plus order norm xi cubed. So this is locally what, so an index minus 1 looks like. You take del bar of it, and you just see it's going, it's xi bar. So it's winding once the opposite direction, so it has index minus 1. Right, so you can see why this is an index minus 1 complex point at the origin. Okay, now, what I'm going to show you is that what we're going to do is we're going to get rid of such a thing out of your surface. So this is what I call a totally real blow-up. The totally real blow-up. So the idea of the totally real blow-up is that you can take your surface, which is given locally here around this complex point, and you can just attach a copy of RP2, what's called a cross cap, which I'll write down in a second, to it at that point, around that point, in a neighborhood of that point, and you remove it, and it becomes totally real. You can actually kill minus 1 these hyperbolic complex points by attaching an embedded cross cap. So let's think about what's a cross cap. So a cross cap, there's different ways to write it. So it's an RP2, you know, that you've cut a disc out and you're about to glue it into something, or RP2. So the way I would think about it, I guess, is as an annulus where you have identified opposite edges of one of the sides. So this is a cross cap. And of course, we're going to glue this circle. This is the part we're going to. If you close it up, you'll get RP2. And this here is right, the topologically what we're. Now, in fact, you can write it down in coordinates. You can write it down mu mu bar mu. And so it's a natural way to write it here. Square the norm of mu is between 1. And 1 minus epsilon, just in some annulus around 1, the inner annulus of 1. So I'm taking it. Okay, so what you see here, well, it's essentially, you just do it, it's an annulus, but when you come down to this norm of this being 1, you get 0 here. This is not 0, it's a circle, and it's squared, so you get a double identification. So it's a double identification. You can see as the norm of nu goes to 0, you're just getting it's double covering a circle. And that's exactly what you're doing here. And as you come up in the circle, then you identify opposite points because of this square here. Now, the idea is that you can compare these two, and in fact, you can take these local expressions and you can just glue them together. So you can actually smoothly glue these two together along this inner radius, the 1 minus epsilon. So this is the theorem. So the theorem, so this is the extension of the local theorem to the global theorem to the local. So let M, J be a complex surface. Sigma, real surface. It can be open or closed, doesn't matter. With a single hyperbolic, so index minus 1, complex point. Okay, so then there exists similarly, I should say, of course, embedded, everything's embedded here, and this is connect some with an RP2, which is equivalent to attaching along a circle here to the one up there. Such that, well, what is the property? Well, as the name says, sigma tilde is totally real. And it's a small addition around the complex point, totally real. So this is just one way of it. It's totally real. So what that's telling us is that we can glue in an RP2 and kill a hyperbolic complex point. And it's just you have to compute this, you have to do the gluing, and you have to see that somehow that, well, it can be made totally real. And it can be done on a small annulus around, which is a small neighborhood of the complex point.
So literally mm-hmm. That means that on your picture there, that three-prong
yes.
Cut out a little disc around that one, glue in something else, and now there's no singularity of the foliation?
Exactly. You glue in an RP2, and you've killed the foliation. Yes.
Can you draw a picture of that?
I have one printed out, and I'll give it out in 1 second. Let me just also say, how would you see that? Maybe it's a good time now to see it. Okay, so I can pass them around. So if you look at the picture that's coming around, maybe I should keep one of them just so I can refer to it. Okay. The top picture is a surface. So this is page 8 from the archive preprint, global to local, if you want to see it. So on the top there we have a hyperbolic complex point, which corresponds to a surface in R3 with an umbilic of index minus a half. You can kind of see there. It's like a three-pronged umbrella or something. That's, I guess, the way to see it. And then in the first picture there, I've drawn the normals. I've picked a constant Gauss radius using the inverse image of the Gauss map, and I've drawn in the normals to that. Okay, now what you see underneath is a sequence. What I'm doing is I'm starting out with the circle and then going by constant radius. And each one of these radii is a one-parameter family of oriented lines, which is a ruled surface. So what you see is a sequence of ruled surface where you're taking the normals, something that was normal to the surface originally, and now you're kind of putting them through each other, and at the end you double cover this cylinder, right, which is a circle. Right? You can see the double covering of the cylinder in the last step there. the very bottom of it. So that is precisely attaching. So what you're seeing there is attaching a cross cap to a surface of this umbilic, of the, and you can see it, you know, you're double covering that circle in the middle. Moreover, the first argument might say, well, when we look back at Lie's formula here, your Euler characteristic is going to go from 2 to 1. That's the wrong direction. But in fact, the Euler characteristic of the normal bundle has gone up by 2. So how has it gone up by 2? Well, if you take that that whole sequence of pictures and you move it to the side, you're always going to have points where the line doesn't move in that circle. And you'll get 2 of them. You'll get precisely 2 of them. And so you will get a self-intersection now will increase by 2. Okay. So you take a circle. That's your central cylinder, if you like, in this. And then you move it, and of course it'll always intersect in 2 lines. So you've picked up 2 from the oriented normal, and the Euler characteristic is a normal bundle, and you've lost 1 from the Euler characteristic as a tangent bundle. So overall, you've gained 1, which kills an index minus 1. Okay, so now you can see why you get rid of just the minus 1s because of this construction. Okay, so how are we going to use that? In fact, this really shows you the sidedness of the umbilic bound, the index being less than or equal to 1 or 2. The sidedness in the local version comes precisely from this topological construction or the semi-local construction. So the theorem then, using this, I'll show you how you use this. So again, this is myself, Wilhelm, in 2012. Says the following. Let S be a C3 alpha surface, smooth surface, convex, with isolated umbilic point. Then again, this is expressing this in R3, that the umbilic index must be less than or equal to 3 over 2. Strictly less than 2, okay. So let me now show you how that follows from the global results that I alluded to and this construction. Before I do that, recall from the first talk, in the real analytic case, Hamburger claims that the index is less than or equal to 1. So there's a sharper estimate here than we get. We just get kind of the minimal so that the global result is true. I mean, that's essentially what we get. We get no more than that. Okay, so I'll come back to that in a second. So let's see, how does this follow from what we've done and what this construction I've just laid out here? So the idea is, proof. So what you do is, suppose you're in R3 and you have a piece of a convex, now this is the local version, so you just have some small piece of a convex surface, and suppose it has a point, an isolated umbilic point, and suppose it has index 2 plus k over 2. For k greater than or equal to 0. So this would be a counterexample to this statement. Right, so it could be 2 or bigger. So suppose we have that. Okay, secondly, once you have that, what we're going to do is we're going to close this up and we're going to construct something that has both property 1 and 2 again from the global result. And so the same contradiction at that level will in fact give us this local one. So how do we close it up? Well, the first thing we do is we take a totally real Lagrangian hemisphere. So this in R3, this would be an umbilic-free hemisphere. You can construct these easily, umbilic-free hemisphere. And again, this is where we'll be doing the mean curvature flow argument is going to take place, and this is why we will take that. Now, you can take this a small disk. You can, in fact, go out. You can do this whole thing out somewhere further out along the normals, but you can always close this up far enough out so that you get a closed convex surface. Now, inside here, of course, you're going to now have complex points. Now, generically, these complex points, or these umbilic points, if we're drawing it on R3, these umbilic points will have index a half or minus a half. A half or minus a half. But the sum, they'll sum to minus k over 2. Because the total, this is a closed convex surface, the total, the winding number is 2. Total winding number should have our complex points, umbilic index should be 2. So it's minus k over 2, these sum up to. Okay, so that's the kind of ones we can just wiggle this a little bit and we'll get these umbilic points generic. Next, what you do is you cancel the plus and minus a half ones. Any plus a half ones you have there, you can get rid of. Right? You can do this, it's like a relative version of the H principle in the Lagrangian category. It's not particularly hard to go through the details. But the next thing you do is you cancel the plus a halves with any minus a halves pairwise. And you can do that in a C0 small manner, in fact. Okay, so then, so you cancel those. So what we then have is your index up here is 2 plus k over 2, and you'll have inside here, you have your hemisphere down here, and inside this region, you will just have k minus a half, k hyperbolic, umbilic points or complex points, whichever you want. Okay, so you can go immediately. You can construct such an object where you to have a piece of a surface with an index 2 plus k over 2. So you'll have k umbilic. Now we go to TS2. In TS2, this would be index 4 plus k. It's multiplied by 2, and these would be minus 1s. These are the minus 1s, and then you have your hemisphere at the bottom. So this is your surface, which I'll call sigma, and now we use totally real blow-up k times. Totally real blow-up k times. So you can get a new surface, connect some k copies of ORP2, and in doing that, k times, you can kill. So here you're just attaching it. This is in the Fourier manifold. You're attaching these ORP2s, these cross caps, at each one of these. And this cancels each one of these hyperbolic umbilic points. Okay, so at the end of the day, what do we get? Well, this surface now has property 1 and property 2. Its sigma prime is an embedded surface. Embedded, it contains Lagrangian disk, our hemisphere. There is this Lagrangian hemisphere in it. And it has one umbilic point. Unique umbilic point. A complex point, I suppose. So impossible. So now the same arguments from the global side, which says that, well, it'll have no co-kernel because it has a single complex point, and on the other hand, it will have co-kernel because you can always attach holomorphic disks to this Lagrangian hemisphere on the other side. So between that means it has co-kernel. So between those two, then, you can't have start. If you had such a thing, you would have such an impossible object just by this construction. Okay, so notice that this is just enough to give you a kind of the weakest local one that would imply the global one. Right? So in running backwards, of course, I suppose that's what you expect. But however, it does raise the following question. So in the smooth case, we have the index is less than or equal to 3 over 2. And in the real analytic case, then the index of the point is less than or equal to 1, according to Hamburger, using completely different methods. So I guess you can ask the question of sharpness in our methods, I guess, of the correctness of the real analyticity, the real analytic case. However, the implication is that there exists, so the question, if you like, is defined. I don't have such a thing in front of me. Obviously, it'll be hard to construct because it won't be real analytic. Does there exist a smooth, non-real analytic of necessity surface in R3 with an isolated umbilic point of index less equal to 3/2? From what I've said here and the extent to which this method fails to sharpen that, it would suggest that, yes, there should exist such a thing. And, in fact, it's kind of an interesting thing. If you look at the split between the category of smooth surfaces in R3 and real analytic surfaces in R3, umbilic points turn out to play quite an important role. In some way, umbilic points are kind of the places where real analyticity appears or doesn't appear for closed surfaces. Somehow it's a crucial element of this distinction between smooth and non-real analytic surfaces. There's beautiful examples of surfaces in by Hopf in the, I think, 30s and 40s where they're smooth but not real analytic, and they can't be real analytic. They have certain properties which force them not to be real analytic. And all of it comes down to computing these surfaces at their, well, computing the germ, where the failure of real analyticity is always exactly at these umbilic points. That's where the radius of convergence goes to zero. That's what tends to happen in these cases. Okay, so, well, at this point, I guess I'm going to finish just to say thank you for listening. I suppose the Carathéodorou conjecture is an old conjecture. I mean, I think up to this, you probably couldn't consider it as a great conjecture because it hasn't led to a lot of interesting mathematics, but I hope I've, at some stage, convinced some of you that the mathematics behind this is interesting enough, and thank you for coming. Well, you don't really know. I mean, the simplest one would be it looks like this, and it looks a bit like a dipole on this side. That's kind of a mixture of a 1.5. Right. You can just write down what the foliation. It goes, then it kind of loops around the surface and comes back like that. Yeah. You can write down, of course, you can write down foliations of all indices. And you can, in fact, there's a formula. You have hyperbolic sectors and elliptic sectors, and then it's a difference between those over two. There's a formula that tells you can write down. And so you can add certain types of leaves that cancel each other. So you could make it arbitrarily complicated to construct such a one. But it would look like that.
I think you explained this. And I might have missed it because I came in a little late. Mm-hmm. When you're doing the mean curvature flow, you need to keep the boundary on the good hemisphere.
Yes.
That's what the constant.
That's part of it. Yes, that's certainly part of it. That controls aspects of it. There's two things that happen. So, I guess when you want positivity, you don't want the surface to pick up a null direction. You want the metric to remain positive on the flowing surface. If you fix the angle to be constant at the boundary, in order for it to go bad at the boundary, it has to run off the positive part of the disk. So, in fact, right, the two of them can go to null at the same time. They go to, if you fix the angle and one of them goes null, they both go null. And so keeping it positive at the boundary, part of that is stopping it from running off this hemisphere where it will no longer be positive. In fact, even to the boundary of the hemisphere, you don't want to go too close to the boundary. So it's exactly that stickiness that you increase to stop it from running off the disk to ensure positivity at the boundary. Yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah. When you use totally real blowup, are you changing the topology of TS2?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, no. It's only of the real surface inside. So we're just adding something locally in a small patch. So we're not making connect something with CP2, for example, which would be a real blowup. A complex blowup. So no, we're not doing. All we're doing is changing that surface and the way it's embedded in your four manifold. Yes, you're just adding this RPT to it. Yeah. but nothing's happening to the ambient space. Yeah. It's gluing.
Well, I asked you before about the genericity argument, mm-hmm. which seems to be just as key as, I haven't really, do you want to explain a little bit more about that genericity argument?
Okay.
I mean, maybe what you told me.
Yes. Okay, so
the argument, there's property one and property two, and I think this is property one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you're actually saying that you can make a deformation. I guess I didn't really quite understand all the. So could you go over property one a little bit?
Okay. Right.
Because it seems to me that the proof rests actually on, you might say it's the encourager's law, rests on this argument as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the idea is that if you take, you want to look at the set of all Lagrangian surfaces, you can give that a nice topology to alpha topology and all, that's fine. What we want to do, though, is when in the case where it's not totally real, so there's a bad point, we want to construct a model for this surface which is J of it, by J of a nice, Banach space, so that you can construct a Banach manifold. And it's going to go wrong at this point. And the idea is that if you fix that point, of course, well, then it would seem to allow you to have the J to drop off in a manner that allows you to still make the same argument that the deformation space is still good. So what we do is we construct the deformation space when there is a complex point, and you fix precisely that complex point. Now, the reason you can fix a point is because of the big action, the action of the Euclidean group, which is both symplectic and holomorphic. So it will preserve being Lagrangian, and it will also preserve any solution to the Delbar equation attached to it as a boundary condition. And so because of that, you can, if you like, fix one point, and then you can construct a Banach manifold that's not sensitive to exactly how fast this complex point falls off. Because the problem with this is you've got kind of a degeneracy there. And you could ask, well, you can start looking, what's the degree of degeneracy, etc., and you could go at it from that point of view. And that's kind of close to the real analytic approach. That's, in fact, precisely the real analytic approach. But what we say is, no, well, you can just quotient out by the Euclidean group, and you don't have to look at the set of all Lagrangian surfaces passing through a point from the sub-manifold topology of the set of all ones, because that and then try and model its deformation by a specific J. Because if you do that, well, then it depends how fast J turns, you won't get a map that's onto. Because your J won't necessarily, if it falls off very fast, it's not going to give you certain surfaces nearby if you use the submanifold topology. So the idea is to use the Euclidean group to fix one point. So this is where you quote. And now you do have a good model, and it's fine, and it works. But you can't fix more than one. You can only ever fix one. The group is obviously not big enough to fix two, and so you can only do this for one. And once you have that, then once you have your Banach manifold structure, which is not sensitive to just how fast it's falling off at this point, once you have that, well, then all your argument, because you can introduce, you can say, okay, well, suppose it's not degenerate to order such and such. Oh, okay, you can prove. You can prove the Carathéodory conjecture locally by assuming some fall off. Well, assume it doesn't fall off at this, and then you prove it, and then you go next one. Suppose it's non-degenerate to order 10. Okay, well, then you prove it.
So you can
yes, in the non-degenerate case, but your definition of non-degenerate is so tailored, you can't exclude what's generic.
I see, but you can prove it.
Oh, yes.
If you make various assumptions, the real analytic case.
Exactly. The real analytic case says, assume it's non-singular to certain order. Then you go up higher and higher, and you try and chase the non-degeneracies up through the power series. And so you can do that. You can prove. So if you prove, say, oh, well, generically, the Carathéodory conjecture is true, because generically the index is a half or minus a half. So to some people... Okay, so now it's a question of how generic are you going to insist that this non-singularity occurs. And now you're battling between genericity and power series. And this is the history of the subject. And we're trying to avoid all of that by saying we don't care how lag with the fixed point sits inside, you know, and how J would give you a good model for how it sits inside the whole set. We just use the Euclidean group, which you have for free, for one of the points and fix it, and then you get a good Banach manifold structure, and then you can go through. And it's weaker,
well,
and it doesn't allow you to, you don't get into those arguments. And transversality follows, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, but we argue that it's not in the definition of the spaces is where the subtlety lies, not in the transversality argument. You still have it. You need a transversality argument, but you certainly, it's standard in some sense. It's not.
Well, the transversality that would fall into the case that when you do all the specific
yes.
power series arguments, you get
what you want.
Yes,
exactly. Exactly. But we want to avoid trying to prescribe how fast this complex point is falling off, so we can't fix more that, you know, we
no,
just...
I have to see the details.
Okay. But that would be... And you're right, it is absolutely... It's essential to understand why it is that you can only fix one point and you can't do more, because obviously you'll have overreach in your result. Obviously you have to... It has to come down very sharply to that.
So is an analogue looking at some... space or what have you with functions just on the real line,
uh-huh.
but functions which have, say, a single zero,
yes.
and asking, you know, for some subspace topology of those inside some standard function space versus using
yes.
the translation group of the line,
I guess.
To see it as a quotient?
I guess so, yes.
And you're saying there's something in the functional analysis in those
okay.
spaces and the topology?
Okay, it's slightly because you see it's the winding number that you're trying to control. So it's a fully two-dimensional problem. So I'll say the analogy may be true, but maybe the statement is not specifically true in that case, right? Because you have this winding number of this complex function in a, you know, in a, you know, C to C, and you've got a little bit more than just a real to a real.
No, but you said the issue was the linear, the topological linear space topology. Right?
Yes.
So I could think as a model problem, mm-hmm. just to try to understand where
okay.
the issue is just about topological vector spaces.
Mm-hmm.
I could think of that model problem.
Yes, certainly the analogy is there. Yes.
No.
Yes.
So, but I mean, this is what I asked before. So you take the C alpha space, or
mm-hmm.
whatever. I don't think that really enters. I mean, and so there are two different kinds of topologies you can put on
mm-hmm.
this thing, spaces of functions that vanish at one point.
Mm-hmm.
I see why they're very different. One comes from just looking at the spaces of C alpha functions that vanish at a point,
mm.
and one comes from looking at the space of all functions and dividing out by
mm-hmm.
the Euclidean group.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I see that they seem to be quite different spaces.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep.
Different spaces. I mean, they're
yes.
actually quite different
yes.
spaces. It's not a question of different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I understand, but it,
no, well, I'm asking.
In that case, you can get a slice of the group action. I mean, I don't know here. I have to think about that Euclidean group action.
Well, he's saying, and he might be right. The translations aren't going to be any different than they are. The model problem that you brought up is not going to be any different as far as the analysis goes. The translations are the translations. I'm trying to remember the examples of the quotient spaces which are not Hausdorff.
But don't forget specifically the local model that you have is using J, right? So you have infinite, right? You're doing the deformation space with respect to this J, which is given by the surface initially, right? So you have to have that. So this is why I hesitate to say you obviously don't have quite so much structure in the example that you're giving. So you can possibly give these things, Matt, you can give them different topologies, you can give them different, but we want one that's good for the del bar operator. So we have to have J there, or else we won't get transversality further down the road.
That is just to understand
okay.
the model space. I mean, I don't quite see why using the topology of J changes the question about what the topology is. Or what the space is, because if you take the space Well, I suppose you're right. In fact, you have J means that the space changes.
Yep.
That is, if you just take the space of maps.
And so if you can make it a good space by saying that you know something about how fast it's going to zero, that J is at a point. Well, then you can just do locally. You don't need any global. You can just do that completely locally. But now you're imposing some condition of regularity or some kind of non-degeneracy condition. And this is one of the things, certainly, in the traditional approach, this local conjecture is find a good notion of non-degeneracy. Well, it turns out you can find many, and you can then start an iterative proof. But, of course, what you have of one that's, you know.
So do these other techniques of proof don't use
No, they don't use anything
except. They don't use the, I see. So in fact, that comes down to the fact that your definition of generosity is different.
Exactly. That we allow it in so that we're, exactly. And it's very subtle global property. That's that.
Thank you. So where do you go from